Did you know that Lyme disease is the most prevalent tick-borne illness, with about 220,000 new cases occurring each year? Believe it or not, you can test negative for Lyme and still be infected. Many victims of Lyme report never seeing a bullseye rash, and it can be very difficult to diagnose because it mimics other illnesses, such as multiple sclerosis, ALS, and Alzheimer's. To learn more, go to www.LymeDiseaseAssociation.org.
You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh 88.3 FM.
Palabras que rebotan, una persona por delante y por detrás, por otra, una promesa rota, palabras que rebotan, una persona por delante y por detrás, por otra, una promesa trucha, puras palabras mulas. verdad y no me prometa lo que nunca llegará. Una vez que se dice algo se hace, siempre no se pasa por alto. Una vez que se dice algo se hace, las promesas no se pasan por alto. Yo me dé una liebre por un gato, lo que prometiste lo espero hace rato. ¿Qué pasó? Se olvidó, no cachó, cuando me lo dijo no ponía atención. Oh, qué pena que me da, yo no estoy seguro cuando dices la verdad. Duda, 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 muchas dudas ahora me das. Una vez que se dice algo se hace, siempre no se pasa por alto. Una vez que se dice algo se hace, las promesas no se pasan por alto. Cuando digo algo y lo cumplo, algo gano, yo siento que triunfo. Pero cuando digo mucho me confundo, me siento como un gusano, como un humano tucho, aucho. Puede ser quizás que yo te llamo, te lo juro, de más obvio que vamos. Sí, 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 como si fuera tan fácil. Mola. Yo lo sé, es difícil decir que no, pero vale la pena. Entonces vamos a aprender cómo N con no es no, N con no es no. Si le pones un gracias, cuanto mejor. No gracias, señor, yo esta vez paso. ¿Porque qué le digo? Que sí, sí, no. Si te confundo a ti, termino confundido yo, yo, yo. Una vez que se dice algo se hace, siempre no se pasa por alto. Una vez que se dice algo se hace, las promesas no se pasan por alto. Una vez que se dice algo se hace, siempre no se pasa por alto. Una vez
son bastantes, son bastante importantes. Cuando hablo, pienso antes, hay que hacerse responsable. Las palabras son bastante importantes. Cuando hablo, pienso antes, hay que hacerse responsable.
And as you sweep the room, imagine that a broom is so- Tuvalu.
Es bon cantar y gritar, solta la voz bien no ar. Bien, bien brillar, esperas, imaginación acordar. Come live the magic, you've gotta have it, just relax and lose control. Magia vida. Sonho viva, é preciso acreditar.
Get it, get it.
I'm Ella Harp, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Hi, it's Tori DeVito. In every family, small conversations can make a big impact. Like when my dad shared his experiences as an alcoholic.
Your honesty about that part of your life gave me a sense of integrity that I wanted to uphold in my own life.
I wanted you to know from someone who's been in recovery more than 30 years now that hard work is what creates success, not alcohol or other drugs. I said it a lot, and I'm glad you took it to heart.
Talk. They hear you. For more information, visit underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
One parent, the green tree frog, Hyla Scenaria, has this call.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. They say that ignorance is bliss, but I know that for myself and many others, our lack of knowledge of Bitcoin and cryptocurrency is only going to hurt us as we try to respond to the dealings around this stuff. Bartlett Naylor breaks it down for us. He works at Public Citizen as a financial policy advocate at their project Congress Watch. Also on the show, billionaires don't need tax cuts. They already have a system designed to appease them, but it's apparently not enough. And part of the budget bill to give more to those who have everything is an effort to sell off public land for exploitation for fossil fuel companies who are determined to die taking their last penny from our fingers. Pulling up the covers and waiting for better times isn't the way. If we stay focused, we can save critical elements of, in this case, unspoiled wild places in the country. Ashley Nunes is public lands policy specialist at the Center for Biological Diversity. We'll hear from her this week about that. That's coming up, but first, a quick look back. I used to say of scholar activist Robert McChesney, who passed away last month, that if he didn't exist, we'd have had to invent him, because he built a necessary bridge between media criticism as an academic enterprise and media criticism as an activist effort to demand that news media be answerable to community and not just another corporate favor. Here's a little bit of a conversation we had with Bob in 2010 on the release of his book with John Nichols, The Death and Life of American Journalism, The Media Revolution That Will Begin the World Again.
Well, the right way to think about it is that in the end, journalism's a public good, much like national defense or public education, and that was obscured for the last century because advertising supported so much of journalism. It emerged out of the blue in the late 19th century, and it provided 60 to 100% of the revenues of journalism. And what happened in the last third of the 20th century was that the private firms that produced journalism, our news media, became increasingly concentrated. They became part of conglomerates, and they were largely monopolistic and uncompetitive markets. And what they were able to do is make more money by slashing back journalists and bureaus. And consumers, readers, audiences, communities had fewer recourse to go elsewhere. And in that context, what you saw, the rational thing for capitalists, for firms, these big companies, was to keep slashing journalism, make more money in the near term, not worry about the long term. And finally, it caught up with them. And then the internet came along, and all it did really was accelerate the process and sort of push over the tottering giant and make it irreversible, leaving us in a situation we're in now where for the first time in a very long time, really in American history, we don't have the resources to provide even a small percentage of the journalism that's required for self-government to work. First, people say the internet killed journalism, they say it's going to solve it for us. It's an interesting argument. The problem with that argument, and we actually spent a whole chapter reviewing what's going on online with journalism, seeing what's working, what isn't, what the problems are. The problem with it is very simple. There's no business model that works. There's no, you know, the number of working journalists who are actually supporting themselves online today in 2010, who aren't affiliated with old media that's paying the bills for the working journalist online, could probably fit in this studio. Or two rooms this size. You know, so we're talking about hundreds of people at most, if that, who are actually getting full pay for doing journalism online, and it's not changing much. There's no business model. Incredible journalism requires paid labor, and that's the problem. We talked to all these wonderful ventures online, and some of them might employ 5, 10, 15 people like Talking Point Memo, and there are others like that. But most of them, especially at the local level, are all going dry. They're saying they're doing it on volunteer labor. And the truth of the matter is it's a public good. We can't expect the market to generated. Advertising is fleeing. They no longer need to support journalism. That era is over. They can go online and find many other options for reaching their commercial ends and supporting journalism. And indeed, to the extent bloggers have to turn to advertising, the strong pressure that, because advertisers have all the leverage now, compromises their editorial integrity to the extent that we don't even want advertising to support journalism if we really want credible journalism. We really got to find another way to do it. And it's just not happening online. The bottom line is that no one can look at the evidence and say, yeah, we can realistically forecast somehow in the next 20 years we will have 100,000 paid journalists in competing independent newsrooms doing the news online. At the current path, we'll have dozens, not thousands or tens of thousands. We're in this free fall collapse. It truly is disintegrating journalism. I mean, we're at the pace now where there will barely be any newsrooms at all, except for those going to elite audiences within 2 or 3 years. But it'll be so small, they'll be meaningless for the most part. And it's a moment in which political choices are going to have to be made. And since the conventional wisdom is collapsing, too, the idea that the internet will solve our problems or that corporate media can just direct electronic barbed wire in the internet and that will solve our problems, those are fanciful ideas that don't add up at all. People are going to be looking around for something that actually will work. And we think this is the only thing that's shown to work historically and internationally. And already in Washington right now, the Federal Communications Commission is beginning a notice of inquiry on the collapse of journalism. There are going to be opportunities. People have to go to freepress.net and the fair.org as well, because there are going to be opportunities for people to participate and say, this is what we want from journalism in our society, and really begin the groundswell of popular organizing, demand the resources and institutions to give us real journalism, not just corporate propaganda.
That was the late, great media scholar Bob McChesney talking with us in 2010. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. I read, thanks to Jake Johnson at Common Dreams, that Trump is planning a fancy private dinner for top investors in the Trump meme coin. It has a dollar sign in front of it, but I don't know how to pronounce that. But it's the crypto token that is enriching him hand over fist, and with other crypto-related investments has reportedly gifted the Trump family $2.9 billion in just the last 6 months. I would be ashamed, but I believe that a lot of listeners are with me as I ask, huh? It's a what? That's doing what? Here to help us make sense of what's happening and why it matters is Bartlett Naylor. He's financial policy advocate at Congress Watch, part of the indispensable group Public Citizen. Welcome back to Counterspin, Bart Naylor.
Many thanks for having me.
What's a meme coin? And why would anybody pay money for it?
I don't know, and I don't know. So a meme coin is generally a term of derision within the cryptocurrency community for a coin that is simply developed as a joke to make fun of something, to take advantage of an internet theme. Folks have heard of Bitcoin, And a meme coin like Bitcoin is simply a digital receipt that you paid money for something. It's not shares in a company that is an enterprise that ideally would make a profit and pay you a dividend. It's just a digital receipt. With Bitcoin, you could sell that to somebody else, and if they paid you more than you paid for it, you'd make money. And that's the idea with Trump's meme coin, which surprisingly, for such a selfless guy, he named Trump. So when you buy one, you are basically sending him money. And you're also having a trading fee, which is where he's actually made most of his money, which also goes to Donald Trump. You get nothing, according to him. He even says on the website, this is not an investment opportunity. You should do this to celebrate me, to celebrate my leadership, my willingness to fight, fight, fight. And he announced a few weeks ago that those 220 that buy the most will be invited to a dinner with him. It's been a little unclear. Sometimes he says the White House, other times he says it's a golf club near Washington, D.C. For background, you can't do this. The law forbids the president from soliciting gifts. The law also forbids the president from accepting gifts from a foreign state. And this $2 billion that you had mentioned is coming from the United Arab Emirates, a sovereign fund in Dubai, and they're going to use a separate cryptocurrency called a stable coin. And again, that's a coin that is tied to a fiat currency such as the dollar. One Trump stable coin equals $1. But basically, when you send him that, you're giving him an interest-free loan.
You know, soliciting gifts, you've just said it, but soliciting gifts is a crime, right? And you wrote to the DOJ, you and others wrote to the DOJ and the Office of Government Ethics to say just that.
Exactly. And so we are waiting on the edge of our seat that Pam Bondi will file a federal indictment of the president. I speak in jest, of course. And Trump controls the federal prosecutors, so for another 3 years and 10-ish months, 9 months, we will await actual accountability for this.
I mean, just to be clear, there are laws. You know, I know that our minds are all blown, but there are laws, there are precedents, there are things to rely on. And, you know, I wasn't a fan of the status quo. I don't want to return to bipartisan gentility, but there are things where you think, wow, I didn't even know that we needed a law to prevent that because no one's ever tried to do that. Where are we in terms of response and resistance?
A number of senators have called this the biggest corruption in presidential history, called for federal prosecution. Senator Ossoff of Georgia, Chris Murphy of Connecticut, Senator Blumenthal, also of Connecticut, has called for an investigation by the Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations. There are calls for this. But of course, we have a captured Congress, a captured Republican Party, and now a captured Justice Department that will not act.
Well, what would you ask from journalism at this point? It's strange times that we're in, and we want to acknowledge that some of the groundwork has been laid in previous administrations, but at the same time, something new is happening. And I just wonder, finally, what you would ask from reporters on this.
Ongoing attention to this crypto grift, because the two main stories of political influence in the 2024 election was the $280 million by Elon Musk to basically buy himself a co-presidency for a while. But the second was $100-some million spent by the crypto industry, mostly to defeat anti-crypto lawmakers, the most prominent being Senator Sherrod Brown of Ohio. And that has sent a chill through all of Congress, and especially Democrats, who otherwise would responsibly be jaundiced about cryptocurrency, but they are voting in favor of it. There's going to be a vote today. We actually don't know the outcome. But it may well enable and give federal imprimatur to the cryptocurrency stablecoin, the kind that Trump just unveiled a $2 billion deal with Dubai. And they're doing that because they're afraid of getting political spending from the crypto industry. The advertisements paid for by the crypto industry don't say, vote for Bernie Moreno because he's pro-crypto and vote against Sherrod Brown because he's anti-crypto. No, the political spending doesn't mention crypto at all. It mentions something else, some problem that they made up about Sherrod Brown or Katie Porter in California or something else. Other PACs have done the same thing. If their own issue isn't particularly popular, they pick something else. But voters need to know that crypto is the biggest bad corruption issue with Trump, and they should hold their lawmakers to account if they enable it.
Well, I'd like to end right there, but I just need to ask you, somebody's like, what the hell is crypto? Like, what is it that I'm concerned about? Do you have like your quick explanation for people who don't even know where to start with this issue?
Well, I would call it thin air, a Ponzi scheme. Cryptocurrency was devised by an anonymous person in 2008. It's somehow a way to have a payment system that doesn't rely on banks. And if we all just use his currency, Bitcoin, then we wouldn't have to rely on the mega banks that had crashed the economy in 2008, like J.P. Morgan. There would be a limited amount of them, and we would just use that. In fact, it has not caught on for a number of reasons. As a currency, it takes a ridiculous amount of energy to validate the transaction between, let's say, you and me, and it's unwieldy. But again, I would call cryptocurrency thin air, and I'm actually quoting President Trump of 2018. He also understood the cryptocurrency was a big nothing. He has since realized that he can personally make a lot of money, so he's drifting away.
Yeah, times have changed. Well, thank you very much for that. We've been speaking with Bart Naylor of Congress Watch at Public Citizen. They're online at citizen.org. Thank you so much, Bart Naylor, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you for having me.
Quote, from lease sales to expedited permitting processes, the committee's proposal creates an unprecedented pathway for developing our vast natural resources on federal lands and waters for generations to come. Close quote. That's a response to a piece of the budget reconciliation bill making its way through Congress, and it comes from the American Petroleum Institute. So you can sense what's up and why our guest calls this piece of Republicans' effort to fund Trump's tax cuts for billionaires nothing more than opportunities for industry to plunder, profit, and pollute. Ashley Nunes is a specialist in public lands policy at the Center for Biological Diversity. She joins us now by phone. Welcome to Counterspin, Ashley Nunes.
Thank you, Janine. Good to be with you.
Well, let's time stamp ourselves. We're recording on May 8th, and this is about the House Natural Resources Committee and their contribution to the Republican House Reconciliation Bill that's going to tell us how to offset the billionaire tax cuts that they want to push through. But it's not a done deal yet, right?
Right.
So it's still in process. Well, there are lots of implications, but what would this plan do, particularly with regard to, I could say public lands, but I really appreciate your phrase, precious wild places. What would this do?
So as someone who's focused on public lands policy, I am most interested in the part of the reconciliation package that's come out of the House Natural Resources Committee. The proposed Republican budget hands over power to private industries to destroy our public lands and offshore waters. The excessive and indiscriminate development of fossil fuels, minerals, and timber will harm wildlife and communities. This reckless development would undermine environmental protections. It would simply, like, make air and water quality worse And of course, that's harmful for wildlife and communities. So this budget bill wouldn't just give tax breaks to billionaires, but it would give polluters the green light to raise emissions, destroy wild places, and harm endangered species.
Well, in particular, I know that you look at, for example, Alaska. You know, we're looking at oil leases in Alaska. We're looking at Minnesota. There are very specific things. And I wonder if you could just kind of lift up some examples for folks to know what we're talking about.
Absolutely. This is not an exhaustive list by any means, but I think I could kind of do some highlights industry by industry.
Please.
So let's start with oil and gas on public lands. This bill would mandate dozens of lease sales every quarter, as you say, also including sometimes in very sensitive locations like the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. There's also at least 4 million acres on the coastal plains of Alaska for oil and gas. Some of the most important bird breeding areas in the country, and really one of the last great wild places, not only in the Arctic, but in the world. Then if we go to offshore waters for oil and gas, this bill would mandate 6 lease sales in Alaska's Cook Inlet and at least 30 lease sales in Gulf waters over the next 15 years. And this offshore oil and gas development, when it pushes into sensitive ecosystems and deeper waters, it really risks another tragedy, like the 2010 Deepwater Horizon explosion and oil spill that resulted in loss of human life and non-human life. The Gulf waters are home to the Rice's whale, the world's most endangered whale. So oil and gas here is really doing the most. The other fossil fuel worth mentioning is coal. This bill would open at least 4 million acres for new coal leasing. Coal is a dying and downright dirty industry, but this bill would have taxpayers subsidizing to keep that industry alive. So across the board, there's reduced royalty payments for these fossil fuel companies for oil, gas, and coal. And even though Republicans say that this is a bill intended to raise revenue, polluters get a really good deal here.
Yeah.
So that's just fossil fuels. And if I could say a bit more, as you said, there's also mining and timber. These are other extractive industries in the bill. So mining, the bill undoes protections put in place by the Biden administration. It pushes through contentious mining projects, one of which you mentioned, so reversing a ban on 225,000 acres adjacent the Boundary Waters Wilderness in Minnesota, and then also a ban on a 211-mile mining road that would stretch across unspoiled wilderness in Alaska. And then for timber, there's a mandated 25% increase in timber production on public lands. And I fear this puts a target on the biggest and oldest trees because of their economic value for timber. A bigger tree would produce more timber. Mm-hmm. But these are also the most ecologically valuable trees for carbon sequestration, habitat protection, and wildfire resilience. So this is a huge giveaway to extractive industry that would be hugely harmful for the places we love.
And maybe to just pull it out a bit, this is opposing what communities want to do with their land, right? You know, land use is a local issue, and we hear hollering about states' rights, but this is actually in opposition to what a number of places have said they want to do with their land.
That's right, Janine. And this is wonky, but there are many provisions across the bill that would take away environmental review. And that's the process that allows the public to have their say, to give their input. So if Congress rubber stamps projects, the public doesn't have that opportunity.
It's so important. And, you know, the fight to resist clean energy in this country is intense, and it's also transparent. And those thumbprints are all over this as well. The right. fossil fuel companies, they're following tobacco. They're just going to hold on to it to the very last penny. And that seems evident in this legislation.
You're so right. There are provisions, as I said, to reduce royalties on fossil fuels. And that's the status quo. But there's also provisions to add royalties for clean energy, renewable energy on public lands. So this is really a giveaway to polluters, and it's to the detriment of that clean energy transition that we need.
Well, I'll just ask you finally, I think transparency is the least that reporters could demand from this process that has such myriad implications. But what would you like to see from journalism on this set of issues, and maybe what would you like to see less of?
There's just so much to say here, really. I think I would just say a couple of things. First of all, we were warned that this would happen. Mm-hmm. This budget bill is the Project 2025 and Agenda 47 playbooks in action.
Right.
It's not just drill, baby, drill. It's also mine, baby, mine, and log, baby, log. This proposal uses public resources to enrich private interests. It's extreme. And if these provisions stay in the reconciliation package and are enacted, this would be an obscene giveaway of our public resources to private industry, and it would put these places at serious risk. It's heartbreaking. I think journalists like you and others can help people understand what's at stake. So secondly, I would just add that we are living through a climate crisis and an extinction crisis. And this budget proposal is one of the worst attacks on the environment that we have seen in our lifetime. It would only cause harm to our cherished landscapes, coastal waters, and wildlife, but also to our public health and our ability to recreate on our public lands across the country. So people want to know what they can do, and ultimately, people need to call their congressional representatives and tell them to vote no to stop.
We've been speaking with Ashley Nunes, public lands policy specialist at the Center for Biological Diversity. They're online at biologicaldiversity.org. Thank you so much, Ashley Nunes, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks, Jeannie.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find decades worth of shows and transcripts on our website, FAIR.org. The website is also the place to show much needed support for the show if you are able and so inclined. Counterspin is engineered by Michael Cherry. I'm Janine Jackson. Thank you for listening to Counterspin. Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, you can say someone supports the rights of people of color to vote,
or to have our experience and history recognized, as though that were a passive descriptor. She supports the rights of people of color to be seen and heard. The homepage of the Kairos Democracy Project has a quote from John Lewis, reminding us that democracy is not a state, it is an act. Tanya Clay House is board chair at Kairos and a longtime advocate for the multiracial democracy that the Trump White House seeks to denounce and derail, in part by erasing the history of black people in this country. As part of that, she's part of an ongoing project called Freedom to Learn, and their present campaign called Hands Off Our History. We'll hear from Tanya Clay House about that work today. Also on the show, corporate news media evince lofty principles about the First Amendment, but when people actually use it, their response is more telling. A favorite example of mine is when USA Today reported on activism in Seattle around the WTO. Quote, little noticed by the public, the upcoming...
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
It's not a gift to me, it's a gift to the Department of Defense.
Grifting and grifting? That's what anti-corruption experts are charging. Over reports, Qatar is preparing to give President Trump a $400 million luxury plane known as the Flying Palace.
Corruption is orders of magnitude worse than Trump won, which was already the worst in American history.
As President Trump lands in Saudi Arabia, then on to Qatar and the UAE, we'll speak with Robert Weissman of Public Citizen, then New York Times reporter Eric Lipton, who's exposed how Trump's two oldest sons are profiting from their dad's presidency, negotiating overseas deals worth billions of dollars. Then to Gaza, where Save the Children's warning every child is now at risk of famine due to Israel's 10-week-long blockade. We'll speak to an Oxfam representative in Gaza City, and then to Abu Bakr Abed, the 22-year-old Palestinian accidental war correspondent who we last spoke to in Gaza.
There's no food available. A lot of people are being taken to the hospital to receive treatment where doctors cannot really give the proper treatment for them, and the medications are not available. Israel has been blocking the two crossings, not allowing a trickle, one single truck into Gaza. And that has really left people on the cusp of imminent death.
Today, Abu Bakr Abed joins us from Dublin, Ireland. His new piece for Dropsite is headlined, The Unbearable Pain of Leaving Gaza. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel's continuing its assault on the Gaza Strip, with at least 46 Palestinians killed and 73 wounded over the past 24 hours. Among the dead, at least two people killed when Israel bombed the Nasser Medical Complex in Khan Yunis. The strike killed photojournalist Hassan Islaya while he was receiving treatment for injuries he sustained in an airstrike last month. He's at least the 215th media worker killed in Gaza since October 2023. It's not the first time Israel's bombed Nasser Hospital. Israeli forces previously struck its emergency building, attacked tents for displaced people outside its gates, laid siege to the complex for over a week, and arrested scores of patients and medical staff. Since October 2023, Israeli forces have bombed or set fire to at least 35 hospitals across the Gaza Strip, each act a war crime. Many human rights groups and advocates charge under the 1949 Geneva Convention. On Monday, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres called for an end to Israel's total blockade of Gaza, in place since March 2nd, after a leading global hunger monitor said Gaza's entire population faces famine. This is UN spokesperson Stefan Dujarric.
Over 70 days into the blanket ban imposed by Israeli authorities on the entry of any supplies into Gaza, stocks have run out, bakeries have shut down, community kitchens are closing daily, and people are starving. This is not a natural disaster, but a human-made catastrophe that the world should not allow.
Hamas has released 21-year-old Israeli-American Eidan Alexander from captivity more than 580 days after the Israeli soldier was taken prisoner during Hamas's October 7, 2023 attack. Alexander reunited with his family in Israel Monday after the Trump administration secured his release in direct talks with Hamas. The deal was brokered by Trump's envoy, Steve Witkoff, sidelining Israeli negotiators who've refused to engage directly with Hamas over the remaining 21 captives still believed to be alive in Gaza. Hamas official called Alexander's release a goodwill gesture aimed at securing a new ceasefire with Israel ahead of Trump's trip to the Middle East, which he began today. President Trump was greeted by Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman as he landed in Riyadh today, the first stop on a tour of Gulf states that will also take him to Qatar and the United Arab Emirates. Trump's expected to discuss Iran's nuclear program, oil prices, and Gaza. He's also expected to focus on securing major investments with the three countries, which Trump claims could reach $1 trillion. This includes a reported arms deal with Saudi Arabia for more than $100 billion. Dozens of business leaders are in Riyadh for Trump's visit. Among them are billionaire CEOs Elon Musk and his brother, OpenAI's Sam Altman, BlackRock's Larry Fink, and Palantir's Alex Karp. Ahead of Trump's first major overseas trip, over 800 U.S. health workers called on Trump to demand a new ceasefire in Gaza and immediately allow aid to enter the Gaza Strip. The medical workers highlighted the increased risks to children, pregnant women, sick, and older Palestinians, whom they say are, quote, marching in an agonizing and cruel fashion toward death, unquote. The Department of Homeland Security said it's terminating temporary protected status, TPS, for thousands of Afghans living in the U.S. in just 2 months. DHS Secretary Kristi Noem cited the improved security situation in Afghanistan, but advocacy groups hit back at the suggestion it would be safe for Afghans to return, many of whom were granted TPS because they assisted U.S. forces during the U.S. occupation of Afghanistan. In related news, the Episcopal Church is ending a long-standing partnership with the federal government and refusing to help resettle white South Africans who've been granted refugee status in the U.S. The Episcopal Church cited its, quote, commitment to racial justice and reconciliation, unquote. Some 60 white South Africans arrived in the U.S. Monday as refugees, even though that program has been suspended for all other groups. President Trump said Monday he'll likely speak with Chinese President Xi Jinping in the coming days after the White House announced a deal to temporarily reduce Trump's tariffs on Chinese goods from 145% to 30%. The announcement set off a stock market rally on Monday led by tech stocks, including Amazon, Tesla, and Apple. Meanwhile, the Colombian president, Gustavo Petro, said Monday his nation will join the Belt and Road Initiative, China's massive global infrastructure development project. Petro spoke from the Great Wall of China ahead of a summit of Latin American and Caribbean leaders in Beijing. In an opening address earlier today, President Xi pledged lines of credit worth 66 billion yuan, equivalent to more than 9 billion U.S. dollars.
There are no winners in tariff wars and trade wars. Bullying and tyranny will only isolate oneself. China and Latin America and Caribbean countries are important members of the global South. Independence and self-reliance are our glorious traditions. Development and revitalization are our natural rights.
President Trump signed an executive order Monday directing U.S. drug makers to cut their prices by up to 80%, but the order doesn't include any enforcement mechanisms, and pharmaceutical stocks rose following the news and amidst relief within the industry. In a social media post,